The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Did the virus put Biden in the Oval Office? Authentic Multicultural Education, and Congressman Devin Nunes joins the podcast to talk about digital censorship and Obama's third term. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast. Hey, I've hired a new marketing team to help me get the word out about this podcast. You, that's right. I need you to help me get the word out. I try to make the podcast very unique, cover topics that aren't covered. Try to make it a learning podcast as well as a podcast that kind of affirms things that you may already believe. So please hit the subscribe button and the notifications button so you know when the podcasts are coming up. And please let other people know. Share the podcast with others. I appreciate it very much.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Normally, politicians and political figures have a talent for saying absolutely nothing. And when they say things that don't amount to nothing, they say things that are flatly false. It is very rare that a politician will say something that, upon reflection, turns out to be true. Usually that statement is made by accident. Well, recently, it just came out in a book that one of Biden's top advisors, Anita Dunn, basically fessed up that COVID, in her words, is the best thing that ever happened to Biden. And what she's talking about is the election. She's saying that it was the virus that put Biden in the White House. Now, she said this in an interview with two guys, Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. These are two NBC News writers who are writing a book. And the book is called Lucky: How Joe Biden Barely Won the Presidency. And clearly, the writers and Anita Dunn all believe that the luck was coronavirus. Coronavirus saved Biden. Coronavirus put him over the top. And this is apparently something that is believed by other people in the Biden camp. But of course, you're not supposed to say it. Anita Dunn's offense, this, by the way, is a woman who has worked for six Democratic campaigns. She worked for Obama both in 2008 and 2012. She's saying out loud what you're not supposed to say. Now, by the way, she's not the only one. You remember several weeks ago, maybe a few months ago now, Jane Fonda said kind of the same thing. Jane Fonda said COVID is, quote, God's gift to the left. And I think Fonda was speaking in a broader sense. She wasn't speaking just specifically about the election, but she was speaking in part about the election, that COVID would do something that would make it easier for Biden to prevail in 2020. Now, how is that? In what way did COVID help Biden? Well, one way, arguably, is that Trump was kind of cavalier about the virus. Trump was a little dismissive of the virus. Obviously, it didn't help when Trump got the virus. I think Trump could have helped himself here doing something that my wife, Debbie, recommended. And that is just go in the debate and say to the country, listen, the very cocktail of drugs that I got as the president that enabled me to come through this so quickly. In fact, I was just fine and almost cartwheeling my way out of the Oval Office. I'm going to make sure this is available to every American. I think it would have helped Trump to have said that. But I think that the main factor was not that. It was not Trump's reaction to the virus. It wasn't whether Trump was too serious or not serious enough. It was simply this, that the virus killed the Trump economy. Now, it's been an axiom of politics for many, many years that the economy, for good or bad, is always blamed on the president. this has historically been true. I mean, if we think back to the 1990s, the reason that Clinton did so well, despite impeachment scandals, was quite simply he inherited the Reagan economy. It was the end of the Cold War. There was a massive peace dividend. And the fact that there was a good, it didn't matter that it was Reagan who was the architect of it, not Clinton. Clinton didn't really do anything to produce that roaring economy, but it was there and he got the credit for it. Same happened with Obama. Now, with Obama, it wasn't exactly the same thing. With Obama, in fact, he inherited the opposite. There was a 2008 crash right before Obama took office, so the economy went into a crater. Well, there was no place for it to go but up from there. And so as the economy climbed out of its doldrums, there wasn't anything fundamentally wrong with the economy per se. It was just the real estate speculation and the congressional intervention that produced the crash, the mortgage-driven crash of 2008. As the economy got better, Obama got the credit. That helped him to get reelected 4 years later. Now, same, I think, is can be said of 2020. Trump had a roaring economy. He was, in fact, the architect of it. Hardly anyone even bothers to deny that. But the fact that the virus wrecked the economy, and wrecked it not for a week or 2 weeks, but we've now been in a virtual shutdown for almost a year, I think all of this clearly helped the Democrats. And there's historical precedent for it. In fact, I went back and looked at the flu pandemic of 1918-1919, so 100 years ago. Woodrow Wilson was in his second term. And of course, it was also World War I, so there was a lot going on. But the pandemic helped to discredit the Wilson administration. He was blamed for the economic collapse and the economic stagnation of the late teens, a century ago. Wilson couldn't run for re-election. I mean, he had already had two terms, but in those days, you could run for a third term. So the Democrats ran, and they ran against the Republican ticket of Harding and Coolidge, and Harding and Coolidge blew them out of the water. In fact, looking at the results, Harding and Coolidge got 60% of the vote. The Democrats only got 40%. The Democrats basically won the Deep South, mainly by using the old Democratic tactic of racial politics, of white supremacy, if you will, and the Republicans took the rest of the country. So the bottom line of it is that economics really matters, the economy matters. And what COVID delivered, a kind of, you may almost call it manna from heaven to the Democrats, was COVID delivered a wrecking ball into the economy, and that perhaps more than any other single factor hurt Trump and helped Biden to make his way, stumbling and bumbling, into the Oval Office. It's really fun to have all of Mike Lindell's MyPillow products all over our home, and we especially love his towels. Well, Debbie and I are kind of particular about our towels. We actually want towels that dry us. What a concept. MyPillow towels are soft to the touch, without the kind of lotiony feel. Proprietary technology makes them highly absorbent. Other towels feel good, but they don't really absorb. MyPillow towels are available in multiple styles and sizes. They're machine washable and durable. 10-year warranty, 60-day money-back guarantee. For a limited time, 2-for-1, low price and free shipping on the 6-piece sets. And you can save 30% on individual towel options with promo code Dinesh. So call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com, but make sure to use promo code Dinesh. Almost a generation ago, Ronald Reagan warned us that the government is not necessarily our best friend. Listen.
9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help."
Exactly. But the Democrats right now are very excited because they believe that in an age of lockdown and coronavirus, government has come to the rescue. And here is Kamala Harris just downright excited about about what the government is able to do for you. Listen.
The president promised help is on the way. And today, help has arrived. Help has arrived for the workers who lost their jobs. Help has arrived for the students who have been stuck at home. Help has arrived for the families that have struggled to put food on their table, and for the small businesses that have struggled to keep their doors open. Help has arrived, America.
Help has arrived, America. Now, what are they talking about? And by the way, Kamala Harris isn't alone here. Apparently, Biden, they're going to get him out of his nighttime slippers, put some shoes on him, and give him a shave. He's apparently going to go on a Help is Here tour. A Help is Here tour. To tout the benefits of COVID relief. It's sort of like your great-grandfather is back to tell you that he saved the day. Now, how has he saved the day? Kamala Harris was talking, for example, let's say you have a small business. Your small business has been shut down now for a year. Think about that. Think of what that means for your revenues and your family and your stability. Now, they're talking about giving people a $1,400 stimulus check. And I don't want to minimize, $1,400 for a lot of people is a fair amount of money. It comes on top of two earlier Trump stimulus checks, a $1,200 check and then a $600 check. So let's add it up. $1,200 plus $600 is $1,800 plus $1,400 is $3,200. Now imagine someone who has been unemployed or someone whose business has been wrecked with no easy prospect of starting up again. Because think about it, if you haven't had you haven't had customers for a year, you have to ask the question, are they ever coming back? If they're out of the habit of shopping in my store or buying my stuff, have I lost my business completely? And then here comes the government and they go, hey guys, relax, no problem, we got this. Here's $3,200 to cover you for a year. I think this is insulting. It's embarrassing. It's almost. You would have to be a craven sucker to feel this abject sense of gratitude. You'd have to be under the mental control of the left to respond in this way. Now, for the left, I think a lot of this is about mental control. There's a very insightful observation. Unintentionally insightful, in the diary of Mary Chestnut, who was the wife of a South Carolina senator, James Chestnut, in the days of slavery. And she was a defender of slavery. She wrote a diary called Mary Chestnut's Diary. And she is mocking the Yankees, the Northerners, for saying that the slaves don't like it on the plantation. And Mary Chestnut is saying, that's not true. And here's her proof. She goes, now, if slavery is as disagreeable to the Negroes as they say, why don't they all march over to the border where they would be welcome with open arms? So here's Mary Chestnut's point. She's saying, yeah, there's a civil war that just started. Our men, our husbands and sons are fighting on the front. They are part of the Confederate Army. We, the women and children, can't force the slaves to stay on the plantation. If they didn't like it, why don't they leave? Now, of course, what Mary Chestnut is really saying, this is reading between the lines, is that we, the planter class, control not only the bodies, but the minds of the slaves. In other words, we have a psychological hold on them. And the reason they don't leave is because they're captive to us. They don't know where they would go. They are driven by a kind of craven fear that they could never make it on their own. At some level, they crave the security of the plantation. And this is the point I'm getting at here with COVID. The Democrats want all of America to feel this way. They want to feel like we have very little, we have nothing, but where else would we go? The government is the only helping hand that we have to depend on. They want to take the mentality of the plantation and extend it across all of America. So this is the Democrats' ploy. They want to show you that they can demonstrate the wonderful workings of the government. But I think that the opposite is true. What we really learn from coronavirus is how impotent the government is, how easy it is to wreck the economy. Government can do that. Government can play a very active role in doing harm. And look at the amount of harm it's done. In fact, when I think of this coronavirus relief, I think to myself, well, yeah, the virus did what it did. But a big part of that was done by the government itself. Who shut us down? The government did, by order. So it wasn't that these businesses failed and government came to the rescue. Essentially, the government created the wound, a deep wound. And now it's showing up with this little pathetic Band-Aid and going, help has arrived, help has arrived, be excited. No, I'm not so excited because you're the one that caused the harm in the first place. Government can wreck things very easily, but it's not so easy to build them up again. Handing out these paltry $1,400 checks, yeah, it's going to help. Yeah, it's going to provide some respite in a miserable situation. It's not going to get the economy back on track. It's not going to put workers back in the saddle. It's not going to give us back what Trump gave us, which was a roaring, bustling, energetic economy driven by American enterprise and animal spirits. That's the America we want back. And these two pathetic characters in the White House, the doddering old guy and the cackling woman, no, they're not going to give us back the America we want. Government really can't do that job for us. Do you ever feel the urge to push back against the leftist media narrative of cops being your enemy? If you support our American law enforcement, I want to share with you a special and very stylish new way to show that you have the back of the police. Eggard Watch's CEO Elon is an unapologetic supporter of police and is taking a very strong stance against this defund police movement. He designed a commemorative police watch that is beautiful. I noticed special details like the engraving and quote on the back. Elon shared with me that in consulting with officers on the watch design, they asked for an image of St. Michael on the piece. Eggard Watches gives away 15% of all sales from this model to police charities. If you haven't seen Elon's Speak Truth short film on this topic, it's a must watch. You can find it on the Eggard website. Remember to apply the podcast's unique promo code Dinesh to your police watch order so you can save over $30 at the checkout. Visit EggardWatches.com, EggardWatches.com to make your order. It's time we support companies that stand up for what we believe in, and Eggard is a company I'm proud to recommend. The vaccines are rolling out worldwide for COVID-19. And as you know, there are different companies that are making these vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna and AstraZeneca in Europe and Australia and Canada, and then Johnson & Johnson vaccines as well. But there has been an interesting issue raised, mainly by the Catholic bishops in connection with the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines. Evidently, these are vaccines that use tissue from aborted fetuses in their development, production, and confirmatory testing. I have your article about the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops, which is just kind of notifying Catholics in Canada that this is the case. And affirming the teaching of the Holy See, this is the Pope in Rome, that we should be very careful about cooperating with evil. That's the phrase, cooperating with evil. Now, the Holy See has apparently said that when other COVID vaccines are not available, it is morally acceptable to use these vaccines, which is to say AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson. But the Holy See appears to be saying that if you have the option of using the other vaccines, you might want to consider that. And I want to just think out loud, without trying to resolve this very complex issue, think out loud about the morality of this situation. Now, for me, the situation is complex, because we are not talking about women who are aborting in order to supply fetal tissue for vaccine research or development. In other words, we're not talking about the intention to abort being connected in some way to scientific research. We're talking about the use of already aborted fetuses who presumably would have been aborted in any case. And using their, well, you'd have to say cadavers, using their cells in the production and development of the vaccine. Now, my thinking on this has been clarified a little bit by the great bioethicist Paul Ramsey. Paul Ramsey was a Princeton bioethicist, a very prominent Protestant theologian and scientist in his own right, and wrote a number of important books. One of them I recommend to you, and it's now a generational, it's called Ethics at the Edges of Life. And it talks about abortion, infanticide, it talks about euthanasia, mercy killing, essentially the moral issues around the edges of life, as he puts it. And Ramsey was very firmly anti-abortion. He was pro-life in every way. And made eloquent arguments against abortion in his many books. And yet Ramsey did draw a distinction. He drew a distinction between, he said that when you're looking at the use of fetal tissue in medical research or medical testing, he goes, you have to make a critical distinction between using living or soon-to-be aborted fetuses, who are in a sense being, you may almost say, prepped for the purpose. That is one thing. And it's a whole different thing to use fetal tissue of fetuses that have already been aborted for other reasons. Now, I realize for some people, all of these distinctions are kind of irrelevant. They want the vaccine. They're kind of morally indifferent. They're like, just give me the vaccine. I've been locked down for too long. And I understand that. I'm talking to people who believe and feel that there is a moral issue here. And I want to address this issue of kind of cooperating with evil. Are you cooperating with evil if you use fetal tissue that has already been aborted in a vaccine? One way to think about this is the difference between, let's say, for example, what the Chinese do, which is they grab their political opponents, the Falun Gong, they kill them and harvest their organs. Now, that is abominable. That is outright evil. It's hard to use any other term for it. But that's a little different for example, from a government that says, we're going to take people who are killed in traffic accidents on the highway, and let's assume that they are not in a position to give their consent. And we have their organs. They're already dead. Their organs are of no use to them. We're going to use those organs to transplant into people who need it for medical research or medical necessity. All I'm trying to say is I think the two situations are completely different. So you make up your own mind in how to think about all this. But it seems to me that it is a false moral equivalence to equate the use of living beings. And in fact, Paul Ramsey was very careful. He even said, look, I'm not even making a point specific to abortion. The use of any living being for medical experiments. Let's say you decide these people are very old. Let's sort of take their tissues. Let's take some of their organs that they probably don't really even need. They're on their last legs anyway, and let's use their organs. No, you can't do that. So Ramsey's point is that this is not a restriction specific to abortion. It is wrong to use living beings, living human beings, in medical research in this way. But it is a morally separate question as to what you do with human beings that are dead. And in the case of abortion, whose moms terminated them, killed them, for reasons having nothing to do with medical research. In that case, Ramsey said, I don't take the same position. I don't have the same sense of abhorrence. It has to be viewed, you may say, in a different light. I've been telling you about Birch Gold Group for several weeks now. I buy my gold from Birch Gold, and so should you. And I'm excited. Birch Gold has just passed a major milestone, 10,000 customers. That's 10,000 people that have a plan against radical leftist policies driving up our national debt and devaluing our dollar. If you've been waiting to call Birch Gold to convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver, now is the time. Through April 30th on qualifying purchases, when you purchase precious metals with Birch Gold, they will send you a free home safe. That's right, a free safe to securely store that gold and silver. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on a precious metals IRA or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. With 10,000 customers, they have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, and they can help you too. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free safe with purchase. I'm very happy to welcome Congressman Devin Nunes to the podcast. Welcome, Congressman Nunes. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. We are now, well, 2 months, I guess, into the Biden administration. We warned before the election that it would be bad news for America if these dudes came in. They're in. Have they delivered, you may say, the goods in terms of beginning the harm that we warned they would do to the country?
Well, they're in the process of it, Dinesh, and thanks for having me on the show. I was joking with you before this. The last time I was supposed to be on, you had that that major power outage all across Texas. So I'm glad you got fixed up and you're going again. At least, but I can say at least you're not in California. That's where I'm coming to you from now. The way that I look at this, if there's any surprises, maybe we'll go with that first. The big surprise is that Biden is clearly not all there. And I think we knew that in the campaign, but I don't believe we knew it was going to be this bad to where they're trotting him out once a day, maybe once a day, you know, 4 to 5 days a week. Looks like he can't even travel. He can't even take a question from their own press department, right? So 95% of the media, you've covered this many times, but I've upped it from 90 to 95% is wholly owned by the socialist democratic apparatus. So Biden's cognitive situation is alarming. I also, the aftermath of the riots on January 6th at the Capitol are also alarming because it continues this two-tier justice system. We had 5 years of corruption of the Department of Justice, the FBI, targeting of Republicans by those institutions with, you know, dirty opposition research. And then you transfer to the Antifa, BLM riots and fires all over the country. And you sit there and you wonder, well, how do we lose this election like this? Well, it's because the social media companies are taking 95% of the content, they're running it through a filter, which is your cell phone, and they're poisoning the hell out of our citizenry. So, you know, the good news is, if there's a lining in this, is 47% of America, they know this, they understand this, and they don't care what the media and the social media companies are saying. But the challenge we have is trying to reach that 5 to 10% in the middle, those average Americans who probably aren't going to, you know, tune into your show. They're not going to watch Fox News. That's the challenge for us, I think, moving forward, Dinesh.
You've actually touched on all the different topics I want to cover. So I want to zoom into some of the things you said in a little more detail. Let's start with Biden. Now, you know, the Democrats are often talking about how Republicans pose a threat to democracy. Because we're trying to supposedly suppress the vote and do this and do that. Now, it strikes me that if Biden is, as you say, not all there, we have a real problem with democracy here because Biden was the guy who was elected. Now, everyone knows that Biden can hire a staff and they can advise him. But if he's not directing them, but they are directing him, then we have an unelected group of people that the American people did not sign up for, who are making the critical decisions. And you may say Biden is just riding in the canoe, but he's not the one manning the oars.
Yeah, I actually say sometimes that Biden is an avatar. So and so is Harris, by the way. What this really is this is Obama's third term. If you look at all the people that were promoted in this administration and that have high level positions, a large percentage of them are actually Russia hoaxers. They're people that were in deep, that were peddling the Steele dossier around to the media and to other my colleagues and the American people. All of these Obama people are back. So, and then you have, I think, another thing that is of interest now. I didn't think anything of it when the Obamas kept a home, you know, a half a mile from the White House. You know, although when you think back to it, that is unusual. I'm not aware of any president in my lifetime that didn't, you know, Ronald Reagan went back to California. George W. Bush went to Texas. Jimmy Carter, I think, went to Georgia. So it's a little odd that you would get a house a half mile from the White House. Now, I only know what the fake news media says, so I can't tell you that it's true or not. But I'm guessing this is not something they would lie about, and that is that Obama's kept a team there in Washington, D.C., and now you effectively have his team running the show. What's interesting is that Obama never supported Biden. It wasn't until he was actually supporting, well, and I say not publicly, but all of his people, all the operatives that are Obama people, they were behind Kamala Harris, who I'm very familiar with her. She was our senator. She was attorney general before that, district attorney of San Francisco. We have a Politburo system here in California. Now, that system has been transferred over to the federal level now almost in full. And that is it. So Harris really never had to run for office. She was never challenged at any of the positions she ran for. She essentially just annihilated the opposition through political maneuvers behind the scenes, and then was on the ballot. Yes, you know, the fake news media will criticize me if I don't clarify this completely. But the point is that she had essentially nominal or virtually unfunded opposition on the Democratic side. And of course, once you make it through a primary in the county or city of San Francisco or the state of California, it doesn't matter if the Republican has $500 million. She was going to win. So
I think,
if you remember,
go ahead.
Yeah, just to kind of finish this thought, Dinesh, she was in 10th place, last place in the Iowa polling before the primary. And that was because there was only 10 people. So she was the only person that she was dead last, despite having all this money in the primary. So she dropped out. A few months later, the Obama team comes in. If you remember, Buttigieg was out, and like four or five people were eliminated from the scene behind the scenes all in one weekend. On Friday, they were saying, we're going all the way. You know, Bernie Sanders is in first, but I'm going to challenge him. Well, by Monday, they were all gone. It was basically Bernie and Biden, and they propped up Biden as an avatar, even though the Obamas and everybody else have to know that Biden is half the man he once was, or even less.
I think Obama was quoted saying not long ago that it would be kind of cool if he could be the decision maker, but not necessarily have all the titles. In other words, if he could be a sort of ventriloquist who could operate through other people. And so this seems to corroborate what you're saying about the regime we're living under now. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more with Devin Nunes. I want to talk about, a little bit about January 6th, but also about digital censorship and cancel culture. MyPillow has a plethora of products, over 100 of them, and they're always adding new ones. And I want to tell you about a new product at MyPillow, slippers. We have the pajamas, we have the robes, and now we have just ordered the slippers. Mike Lindell has women's and men's moccasins or slip-ons. And if you order now, you'll get 30% off with promo code Dinesh. So don't wait. Go to MyPillow.com or call 800-876-0227, but make sure to use promo code Dinesh. Hey, we're back with Congressman Devin Nunes. You mentioned January 6th. It's interesting to me that as new information comes out, it seems to support the idea that we were really fed a narrative about what happened, and a bogus one at that. I want to mention two little details. Apparently, the key oath keeper who was arrested as part of this supposedly grand conspiracy, what the Justice Department calls the widest ranging conspiracy case over the storming of the Capitol, this Thomas Caldwell guy, the judge ordered him released because even though he made all kinds of boasting about, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, the guy didn't even go in the Capitol. So this is the lead conspirator, and he wasn't even present at the scene of the action, you might say. Now, another thing I see, New York Times, this is from a few days ago, FBI finds contact between Proud Boys member and Trump associate. Now, the Trump associate is evidently Roger Stone. So one Proud Boys guy made a call to Roger Stone, whoop-dee-doo. What I found was interesting in this story was the dog that didn't bark. No contact whatsoever between people who got into the Capitol and congressmen and senators. Remember how the Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats were like, oh, we've got to worry about the very people in this chamber because there might be domestic terrorists who are elected members of government. It's very interesting that that has proved to be completely false, and there's been almost no reporting on this. So I think it's not only the information that is interesting, but the way it's being reported or not reported. It seems to me we have a serious problem, not just with digital censorship, but just with the Pravda-type coverage that we're getting of the daily news. And it's almost too much to expect the American citizen to be able to see through this when they don't have other sources of information.
It's essentially the narrative building. So there were many Democrats behind the scenes who knew once this happened, they went full force that very day that they were going to take and label everything that they had been doing. Remember, they are the funding arm behind, or their people are the funding arm behind Antifa, BLM, all the riots that happened. And by the way, are continuing to happen even as late as last week, at least in Portland. So, and even the night of the election, when it looks like Trump had won, there were already riots and rioting that was starting in the streets all over major cities across this country. Now, look, if you want to do a real investigation, this is how it would go down. So first and foremost, it is not okay to break a window and break into the Capitol, period, right? You can't do that. Just like you couldn't break into a federal courthouse or anything else for that matter. It doesn't matter federal or state or even somebody's home. So why would we not be focused on those key core people, identifying the people who had the hammers, who broke the window, who had all the equipment? It seems like you take your top tier of people and really focus on them. Now, they found a few of those, but it seems like when they find out that they may have affiliations with left-wing people or they may be crazy people, those don't get covered. So look, that's the point. Were there, I still don't know, even though I've been in many of these meetings, were there 10 people that broke the window? Were there 50? Were there 200? I don't know, but I want to know those people first, because from there, then you can look at the video footage and you can then say you prioritize the people who broke the windows, the people who were aiding those people that broke the windows that had to know what they were doing was wrong. However, there's probably a large percentage of people, and matter of fact, and I've heard from some of them that have said, hey, we were just there. Because other than the COVID restrictions, Dinesh, it's okay for the American people to come into the United States Capitol. That's not a problem. Now you have to, you're supposed to do it in an orderly fashion. But the question is how many of those people, and I'm not making an excuse for them. I know the fake news will try to say that I am. But look, there's a lot of those people who had no idea. They were just out protesting, which we have a right to do in this country. So I mean, when the doors of the Capitol are open and you come flowing in, and if you take all that, look, there were people who damaged things in the Capitol. I want them prosecuted. There are people that broke the windows. I want them prosecuted. But if you just walked into the Capitol, you have a right as an American citizen to do that. And if you didn't know that you had to like get an appointment, you had to go through a magnetometer, that's not your fault necessarily. So I think there seems to be lack of focus on the people who really did this.
The point for me was I think that when you're in a crowd, you're going to take your cues from the authority figures who were there. And so if you've got Capitol policemen kind of in effect ushering you in or stepping aside to make room for people to move forward, it's hard to see a logic of a crowd that people aren't going to press forward when they're allowed to go in. Now, I know in certain places there was resistance, but in other places there wasn't. Let me pivot a little bit. You might have seen that there are now actions on the part of a number of states. Governor Abbott, I believe, is on this in Texas. We know that Ron DeSantis is doing this in Florida. And this is efforts to now pass legislation that would penalize social media, these digital media moguls, for censoring people who live in that state, whether it's elected officials or ordinary citizens. And I believe this is also going on abroad. Poland, Hungary, a bunch of countries are thinking of similar measures. The basic idea, you censor a guy in Texas, it's going to be a $100,000 fine on Twitter or on Facebook. Is this an effective way to fight back against digital censorship? Do you approve of these measures that are percolating in the states? And should we see, would you like to see more of it?
Well, it is the issue of for the next 5 to 10 years, because these tech oligarchs are so big and so powerful. They're buying up media empires. Even when media is changing, as you're well aware, and it's a tough business to be in, they're adding people, even though these business models are not profitable. So they're becoming essentially, you said Pravda earlier, but propaganda arms for these tech oligarchs. And then you have the Democrats who will sit around there and say, oh, we really don't like you, which really means that, hey, make sure you do what we want. If you don't support our agenda, our promotion of identity politics, our promotion of our narrative, our Pravda-like narratives that we're putting out, then we may look at coming in breaking you up. That's essentially veiled as a threat, but it's really actually it's a threat that would only be implemented if they don't do their bidding, which right now they're all doing their bidding of censorship, and it's censoring conservatives and Republicans. There's not a bigger issue at the highest, more important issue at the highest level. So the federal level, there's not a lot we can do. I mean, we're stuck 4 years with Biden. Look, if we could win the House back, possibly the Senate back next time, we could at least have subpoena power to go in and subpoena these people in and put them through days of depositions to really look at their antitrust issues and the laws that they've been knowingly been breaking now for a while. But Biden, I doubt the Biden Justice Department is going to do much against them because of the two-tier justice system we talked about. So that does give an opportunity for the states. I'm a big states' rights guy. So if these governors and attorney generals across the country, if we could get 20 or 30 of them to do the right thing and say that, look, antitrust monopolies are illegal in this country, they're illegal in this state, and you're not going to censor the citizens of Texas, so to speak, I think that's a positive. I just hope that they move forward faster than what they're doing now. I mean, I like that DeSantis is doing it. I served with him in the House, but I want to see these guys go even faster, because every day that goes by, we're not reaching that 5 to 10% of America that really changes and moves elections, that middle that we talked about in the last segment, Dinesh. And that's what the Democrats and the left don't want us to touch, because at that point, we go from 47 to 55 and they get blown out of the water. They're left with, New York City and San Francisco and Hollywood, which are disaster zones, in Chicago and places like that, versus the red states that are doing very, very well and prosperous.
You're saying it threatens their effort to create a permanent majority. Hey, Congressman Nunes, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks a lot, Dinesh. Please say hello to your wife for me and look forward to being on again.
I've been talking to you about ExpressVPN on this show for a couple of months. Why haven't you gotten a virtual private network yet? Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you this. There's never been a more important time to protect your digital rights. That's why I and thousands of my patriotic listeners choose to secure our online data by using ExpressVPN. Did you believe that a VPN isn't for you because you can use the internet just fine without one? Anytime you go online, your internet service provider can see every site you're visiting. ExpressVPN is an app for computers and smartphones that encrypts your network data and reroutes it through a secure server. That means you can use the internet more anonymously without having your activity tracked. Did you think that VPNs are complex and only for tech experts? Take it from me, they're not. With ExpressVPN, you launch the app and tap just one button to protect yourself. It's really that simple. I trust ExpressVPN to protect my online data because they're rated number one by CNET and Wired, and they stand for my values. Now is the time for you to take a stance. Take back your privacy at expressvpn.com/Dinesh and get 3 extra months free on a 1-year package. Again, that's expressvpn.com/Dinesh to get 3 extra months free. Visit expressvpn.com/Dinesh. We hear so much. In fact, we hear ceaselessly, endlessly, interminably, exasperatingly about diversity in education, multiculturalism in education, identity politics in education. And I think the sad thing about this is that we have gone down a crazy road in this area when there was a better road. There was an authentic multicultural road that we could have gone down that would redound to the benefit of students. So the wrong road, the bad road, is the road of extreme identity politics. The classic expression of this came recently from Jen Psaki, the press secretary of Biden. She was talking about the canceling of Dr. Seuss and things like this. And she goes, you know, kids need to read books in which they can see themselves. Now, at some level, I, of course, agree. The whole point of education is to be able to see yourself, but see yourself in what? See yourself not necessarily or solely in, hey, there's an Indian guy who wrote this book. Hey, there's an Indian character. So I see myself in the visual sense. I see a brown face and I begin to smile. Education might begin like that, but it certainly shouldn't end like that. The real point of studying is to discover yourself or see yourself in situations that are universal. In fact, in people who don't look like you, people who are distant, you may say, in space and in time. And nevertheless, you recognize yourself in those situations because you spot the universality of human nature playing out very often in very different environments. I see here, depressingly, a University of Dayton professor, this guy probably thinks he's serving the cause of diversity, is now ranking law schools according to their degree of whiteness. So it's almost like he's got this white marker and he's identifying law schools that he thinks suffer from, quote, excessive whiteness. And he wants them to, quote, eliminate this whiteness. And his mechanism for doing this is a kind of racial headcount of the number, not just the number of professors in the school, but the sources that are identified, the justices who render opinions. I mean, the whole enterprise is ludicrous and embarrassing. What is the better road that we could have gone down? Well, I would call it the road of authentic multicultural education. It was Matthew Arnold who said a long time ago that we should read the best that has been thought and said. Well, we've been doing that in Western civilization for a long time, but of course there are many great works in non-Western cultures. Some of those are ancient, you know, the Analects of Confucius or The Tale of the Genji by Lady Murasaki, the Ramayana, the great Indian classic involving the Lord Rama, or modern works, V.S. Naipaul, Naguib Mahfouz, the Egyptian writer, Yukio Mishima, his great book, The Sound of the Waves, Jorge Luis Borges in South America or in Africa, Chinua Achebe, his work, classic work, Things Fall Apart. These are multicultural classics, and students would benefit from reading them. So why don't they? Why didn't the left go down this road, expose people to great works in non-Western cultures? And the answer is really simple, that the great writers of non-Western cultures are, for the most part, politically incorrect. So there's the problem. What the left wants is an affirmation of identity politics, and you don't get that from the great writers of non-Western cultures. In fact, you sometimes get the exact opposite. Here's one of my favorite books written by one of India's greatest writers, Neeraj Chaudhary. It's called The Autobiography of an Unknown Indian. A searing self-examination by a Bengali intellectual. But here's the problem. This is why the left would never assign this work. This is his dedication. To the memory of the British Empire in India, which conferred subjecthood on us, withheld citizenship, yet every one of us throughout the challenge, because all that was good and living within us was shaped, made, and quickened by the same British rule. Wow. Cancel this guy. He appears to be sympathetic to British colonialism. Here is a great work by Dadabhai Nauroji, one of the Indian leaders of Indian, the Indian National Congress, the early Indian independence movement. The title alone is very revealing. It's called The Un-Britishness of British Rule in India. What is Dadabhai Nauroji saying? He's basically faulting the British. He's denouncing colonialism, but he's doing it in the name of Western ideals themselves. He's saying that the British are not living up to Britishness. And what we need is not less Britishness, but more in India. That's his point. So you see why these books have become sort of outside the bounds. This is why the left hates them. And so what does the left do? It gives you, I would call it bogus multiculturalism. Instead of assigning the Analects of Confucius or assigning the Chinua Achebe, they give you like, you know, the journals of a one-legged gay Native American in the Southwest. Hello, I'm a Native American. I'm traveling through the Southwest. I'm looking for burritos. I'm looking for bathhouses. Sometimes I find a burrito. Sometimes I find a bathhouse. But I'm only really happy when I find a burrito and a bathhouse. I mean, this is what young people are getting. And then, of course, some professor goes, well, of course, this is a very learned exploration because, you know, our protagonist here has to affirm not only his cultural identity, that's the significance of the burrito, but also his sexual identity. That's the significance of the bathhouse. So by integrating the burrito and the bathhouse, what we find here is a reconciliation of cultural and sexual identities into a kind of a holistic whole. Let's put aside all this nonsense, which turns education into parody. And let's focus on learning real stuff written by great thinkers and great writers who have something to teach us. If you're thinking of replacing your carpets due to pet stains and odors, you must try Genesis 950. The reviews are amazing. This is one product that actually works. With water, it breaks down the bonds of stains and odors so they are gone for good. Its antibacterial component removes pet odors from carpet and padding. It can be used in a carpet cleaning machine, and it's green, so it's safe for your family and pets. Genesis 950 is made in America. 1 gallon of industrial strength Genesis 950 makes up to 7 gallons of cleaner. But Genesis 950 is also great for bathrooms, floors, upholstery, and grease stains. Debbie uses it to clean the kitchen and recently got ink on her pants, and Genesis 950 took it right off. Genesis 950 has great customer service. Order 1 gallon direct at genesis950.com to receive a free spray bottle, free shipping, and $10 coupon code using the code Dinesh. That's genesis950.com. Coupon only available for 1 gallon purchase. Genesis 950. It's much cheaper than replacing your carpets. We don't really need education to tell us about the world we live in. We already know about that world. We need education to tell us about the world we don't live in, which is to say, education helps us to transcend our provinciality in space and time and discover other people and other cultures and discover ourselves in them or imaginatively in them. I've been talking about this, about multicultural education in the good sense, but I thought it's helpful to do it. And to do it means to look at, I'm going to look at a story written by a great Indian writer, Rabindranath Tagore, winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Gandhi called him the great sentinel of Indian literature. And this was a guy who wrote voluminously. His most famous work is called Gitanjali. But we're going to read together at least parts of his a short story by Tagore called Kabuliwala. So a Kabuliwala is a guy who sells odds and ends, fruits, vegetables, little trinkets, things like that. And as the story goes, the narrator, the author, is with his 5-year-old daughter when this Kabuliwala shows up at their house. And the daughter is very talkative and chatty, and the Kabuliwala gives her some raisins and almonds. And the daughter, whose name is Minnie, strikes up a friendship with this dude. Now, today we might think that's a little odd, but of course, in ancient Indian culture, vendors come to the house all day. It's not unusual at all. And the daughter talks nonstop, so she likes the Kabuliwala because he listens very attentively to whatever she has to say. So he comes by every day or two and becomes friends with the little girl. And he often gives her little fruits and little snacks to eat. And one time the father stops in on them and they're having this animated conversation. And the little girl tells the Kabuliwala, "What do you have in that bag over there?" And he goes, "I've got an elephant." And the two of them laugh uproariously. It's obviously not that funny, but they both think it's unbelievably hilarious. And then finally, the way the conversation ends is the Kabuliwala tells the little girl, listen, you know, if you have any trouble later when you meet your father-in-law after you get married, you let me know and I'll settle the guy if he gives you any trouble. Of course, it's customary for girls to be married by arrangement, to go into their father-in-law's house, and that's often a kind of intimidating experience. The little girl knows nothing about any of this, but of course the Kabuliwala does. And then time passes. And according to the narrator, at one time, he hears a commotion outside of his door, and he looks out, and there's a bunch of police there. And they have arrested this Kabuliwala. Why? Because evidently there was someone who owed him money. He went to collect the money. The guy refused. The guy began to punch him and started up a fight. And the Kabuliwala drew up a knife and stabbed him. So the Kabuliwala is a rough guy. And this gives you a little bit of a window into the lives of the very poor. We often think the poor are unbelievably virtuous. No, they live rough lives. And violence is sometimes a normal part of it. And so the Kabuliwala is arrested, he's convicted, he goes away for 8 years to prison. And the narrator and his little daughter forget all about him. And the little daughter now begins to grow up, she gets older, and time passes. And it is the little girl's wedding day. And so there's all the arrangements are going on, and the plans are going on, and the women are bustling around. And suddenly there's kind of a knock on the door. And the narrator opens the door. It's the Kabuliwala. He has been let out of prison, and he has come to see the little girl. And he goes, can I see Minnie, the little girl? And the narrator goes, no, there's something big going on at the house, meaning the wedding. It's not a good time. So the Kabuliwala says, well, you know, it's okay. I just brought some raisins and nuts for your daughter. Please, you know, I'll be very grateful if you give them to her. You see, I also have a daughter. So this guy has his own daughter. And he says, it's kind of with her in mind that I've brought this little gift for your daughter. And then he pulls out a little dirty piece of paper and he shows the narrator this drawing of his own daughter. Which he's been carrying with him all this time while he's been in prison. So the narrator realizes that it's important for his daughter to receive the gift directly, so he interrupts the marriage festivities. All the women protest, oh, no, no, no. But nevertheless, Minnie, who's now a young lady, comes out and she sees the Kabuliwala and he says to her, hey, are you ready to go to your father-in-law's house? Because he realizes that she is now about to be married. And she begins to blush and looks down. And he goes, well, if he gives you any trouble, you better let me know. I'll settle him, just like in the old days, saying exactly the same thing. But the narrator can see the Kabuliwala is kind of discombobulated. He's very flustered. Why? Because he suddenly realized that his own daughter is now 18. His own daughter has grown up and grown up without him. And he's going to have to make a completely new relationship with her in this situation. So he realizes what he's up for, and so does the narrator. And so the narrator parts by giving the Kabuliwala a coin and says, basically, listen, you know, use this to help with your reconciliation with your daughter. And the Kabuliwala leaves. So what are we getting at from this story? I think what we're getting at here is the principles of universality, of recognizing yourself in people who don't look like you. Outwardly, you're looking at people in a completely different world. This is India in the early 20th century, distant both in place and in time. You're dealing with customs, arranged marriage that are very remote. But we can empathize with people very different from us. Think of what it would mean, for example, for this Kabuliwala, who was a mountain man. He was raised ultimately in high mountains and ice and trees and forests. And here is this guy locked up for 8 years, staring at walls. Think of the agony that must have represented for him. The bottom line of it is we learn to undertake voyages like this because we see people very distant from us, who yet are eerily similar to us. And in recognizing both that difference and that similarity, we emerge from these experiences, you may say, wiser than experience could make us. Debbie and I both love Mike Lindell's My Pillows. And the pillows have actually changed Debbie's sleeping habits. When she started sleeping on Mike's pillow, she began sleeping through the night because of that change of life. She's tried everything and nothing worked until she slept on this amazing pillow. She also has one of Mike's body pillows. The cool thing is that these pillows won't go flat. You can wash and dry them as often as you want, and they maintain their shape. They are made in the USA. For a limited time, Mike Lindell is offering these premium My Pillows for the lowest price ever. You can get a queen-size premium My Pillow for $29.98. It's normally $69.98, so that's $40 savings. The King Pillows are only $5 more. All the MyPillow products come with a 10-year warranty and 60-day money-back guarantee. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Dinesh. You'll get deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the Giza Dream Bed Sheets, the MyPillow Mattress Topper, and MyPillow Towel Sets. Call 800-876-0227 or just go to MyPillow.com. Don't forget to use promo code Dinesh. It's now our mailbox time, and we have a very interesting question from a dude from Romania. Listen.
Hi, Dinesh. My name is Mihai, or Michael, if you wish. I'm from Romania and a fan of your podcast. I'm close to your age, so I've experienced life under a communist regime. I've always admired the US and everything it used to stand for. So now it's very sad to me what's happening out there. We are affected by the same cultural war that you are going through for decades, and the local mainstream media is not on the right side. So what goes on in the US is extremely relevant for us. Here's my question. Do you think that the US media outlets have freely chosen to associate with the leftist agenda, or that in fact they are merely instruments of a handful of very powerful people who are trying to change the world? Thank you for everything you are doing, and God bless you.
There are a lot of interesting elements in this question. First of all, I find it striking that my podcast is listened to all over the place, and questions come in from all over. And second, that this culture war, this effort, you may say, to bring down a system of markets, a system of free enterprise, a system that is anchored in a sort of moral order of conservatism or even a transcended moral order. This is going on worldwide. The left is active worldwide. Now, many people who have had the experience of socialism and communism are very frustrated because they say, you know, why don't these guys in the media and in, you may say, the elite, why don't they recognize the harm that communism and socialism do? And if so, why don't they stop it? I think the answer to this question is very simple. Tyranny always involves two parties, the tyrannizer and the tyrannized. In other words, it involves a perpetrator and a victim. Now, it's very difficult for the perpetrator to recognize the evil of tyranny. Why? For the simple reason it's not being done to him. Kind of reminds me a little bit of a scene in the movie Goodfellas where Joe Pesci is playing a mafia guy, is insulted by some other guy, and he essentially kicks the man to death, right? And he doesn't even think about it. Why? Because to him, tyranny is fun. That guy insulted me. I have the power. So don't talk to me about why it's bad to be in the mafia. Now, a little bit later, Joe Pesci wants to be a made man. He wants to get his stripes, you might say. But what he didn't realize is that the guy he killed is also a made man. So when he shows up to get his stripes, he's shot in the head. That's when he realizes that being in the mafia and that tyranny is not so good. I'm sure if you could interview the dead Joe Pesci, the headless Joe Pesci, and you go, hey, Joe Pesci, you think tyranny's fun? He'd go like, no, not when he gets your head blown off. So it was fine while he was blowing somebody else's head off. And the point I want to make is that the media are part of the instruments, the agents of promoting cancellation, suppression, humiliation. They're the ones doing it. They're the tyrannizers. So for them, it's fun. They'll stop when we figure out how to do it to them. When we turn the tables, as the tables were turned on Joe Pesci, when they begin to feel the pain, in effect, figuratively or politically, when their heads get blown off, suddenly they go, ah, maybe the system of tyranny isn't so good after all, when we are not just the perpetrators, but we also find ourselves the victims.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.